Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
This is Lana, and welcome back to Radio 314 after a short holiday break. I do hope 2013 has brought you new unstoppable energy. I think that for the creative spirits out there, the next few years are going to be very inspiring and productive. Today we welcome Spencer Barclay to the program. As a preface, I should say that we dive right into the deep end of the topic concerning the nature of money in terms of using your private exemption, negotiable instruments, bills of exchange, set off and discharging debt, and dealing with creditors. It's quite difficult to wrap your head around at first, and we really need to do part two with Spencer to backtrack some of the starting points we missed in this conversation. Nevertheless, the subject will change the way you view money and debt forever. Before we get into the main topic, I want to say something about money. Today, there is no money, or at least no money of substance, in our current economic system. The exemption concept basically says, I'm exempt from having to pay for anything because there is no money of substance with which to pay. Spencer will explain these concepts in more detail. Hello, Spencer Barclay. Welcome and thanks for being here. How are things going in Seattle these days?
They're windy.
Well, I spent some time checking in your ideas yesterday, and from what I could wrap my head around, it seems as though you're almost tapping into the occult aspects of currency, labor, and property. But before we dive into the nature of currency and money, tell us a bit about who you are and how you first became interested in studying money, law, and our current system.
I don't have any formal background training in this at all. I just studied some things on the internet, and I stumbled across some things where people were talking about accepting their bills, that they would get commercial bills, invoices and statements, that kind of thing, and they would send them back to the creditor, and the account would get paid. And I thought, that's very interesting. And so I just stayed on a path of studying that from a very theoretical point of view. I didn't have an urgency to, I didn't have an imminent bill. And so I had the luxury of time to just take in the concepts and study. And it was just super interesting to me. So I just stayed on that path of studying how can that be that, the bill you get is the remedy for paying it.
So did you want to get into the subject right now?
Sure. Yeah. Once gold got taken out of the system, you know, a lot of those stories are told by, I don't know if it's William Still or William Stills.
Stills.
Yeah. He does a great job of sort of scratching the surface and then getting really deep into some of what happened with banking and money and currency. But I wanted to know the whys behind, how do you connect that story there with you can send in the bill as remedy for payment. And so there wasn't anything available out there to satisfy those questions that I had. And so I just had to dig, directly into that esoteric occult stuff, just like you said. And lots of it is just real dry law books, whether it was law or equity, another table. Digging around in there to find out what status quo is and was in the first place when gold was used, to then compare what we have going on now.
And what did you discover?
Well, what I discovered was that gold is interesting not because it's intrinsic or it's actual or tangible, but that it's property. And so property is just the exclusive right to something. It's not, it doesn't necessarily need to be tangible. And so what happened right at that time where in 33 with HJR 192, that's what pulled gold out of circulation. They did something like a parlor trick where they pulled that type of property out of the system. And they replaced it with our labor.
Explain more what you mean when you say that.
Well, I might have gone too far too fast, but that's what happened in 33. So by our labor, it is it's first acknowledged with the birth certificate that ultimately ends up at the U.S. Treasury, and it is administered with the IRS, and it's tracked with our credit score. But every time we go get a loan, it's already pre-approved. The only way to have gotten a loan in the first place is to already have qualified for it. You've already put the labor out into the system. So to understand that, there's two systems that we'd have to compare, and one is the old gold system,
mm-hmm.
where there was actual property that was either in circulation, or you would deposit gold, and we'd use the bank notes, which are just effectively claim tickets for them.
Right.
And so there's always been at least a bifurcation or a splitting of money and currency. So the money being the property can be separate and distinct from the currency that's in circulation, which is the bank notes back then, or now that we've developed an electronic system. The electronic system is a representation also of property, but it's still a splitting between currency and money.
Mm-hmm.
And so the system still works the same as it used to when we had gold. Now it's just instead of gold as the property, we're using our labor, and the paper currency doesn't necessarily need to be the paper. It can be the electronic, you know, the digits as well.
Mm-hmm.
So and also, this is only one aspect of currency creation too, because there's other elements where the currency gets introduced into the economy, and it's not this. You know, if the United States creates bonds and then liquidates them, I'm not talking about that kind of money creation. I'm talking about the kind of money creation that's talked about in modern money mechanics. I don't know if have you run across that?
Uh-huh, some of it, yeah.
Yeah, that's put out by, I think it was the Chicago Federal Reserve. And it's pretty high or heavy, dry reading. And,
mm-hmm.
but one of the places in there that you'll find is that money is created when a loan is applied for.
Right.
So there's one of the clues, and a lot of these little clues are lots of smaller separate facts that have to be strung together that all kind of point in the same direction. There's no one real obvious explicit place anywhere as far as a source in writing from the system that tells you this.
And so how does property play into this? You were speaking about equity earlier.
Yeah. So a little bit before that, one of the things we have to keep track of in our minds is that money is used to execute a contract. And so if you look up and study and understand contracts from the table of equity, we see that the only way to execute a contract is for property to go in both directions, or as many directions as there are parties. And so if we only use Federal Reserve notes that are borrowed into the system to execute a contract for something that was purchased, property is only exchanged on one side. And it's not exchanged in the direction that Federal Reserve notes traveled. And so that's called a novation when that happens. And so property did not go both ways. We had to use money that was borrowed into the system. And so what that does is it transfers the liability back to whoever borrowed the money. And in that case, it's the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we accept a bill and send it back to Treasury, and Treasury then releases currency back over to the creditor, that was done off of our labor. And now property did go both directions.
I see.
It did. And now we finally executed a contract. We finally extinguished the contract. What we didn't do a novation. We didn't transfer it over to another liable party.
Mm-hmm.
So the remedy's always been in the system to use it. By and large, people just haven't known how. From there, the story gets a little bit complex because, as an example, when we use the borrowed currency, we're paying tax on the rent and on the use of it. And so there's been lots of tax arguments where people are, they would say, hey, you can't tax labor. And the system has never said that that's what they were taxing. You know, if you make, someone makes $50,000 a year or $100,000 a year, that's not what is being taxed. What's being taxed is the type of currency
mm-hmm.
you accepted for it. So, and there's little secret spots within United States code that where you can take and liquidate bills and convert them into currency.
Talk about those.
Okay, so one of them is 31 USC 5118. And I should probably open that up real quick. And it says that currency is exchanged dollar for dollar for other United States currency that may be lawfully held. And so if you first take a look at that, you might think, well, what kind of currency is there? And what would it be exchanged for? Other kinds of currency that may be lawfully held? In other words, that why would someone go to Treasury to have them make change? You know, right. You wouldn't a bunch of $100 bills and have them convert it. And so verbatim, it says a person lawfully holding United States coins and currency may present the coins and currency to the Secretary of the Treasury for exchange dollar for dollar for other United States coins and currency. Then it says other than gold and silver coins that may be lawfully held. So when I looked up, now in their own system, if you go and look up what currency means in Webster's dictionary, it's going to mean something different than the current banking lexicon that they're using now. And so when I looked up currency, it says it's just an item that circulates as a medium of exchange. And then when I looked up item, which you kind of wouldn't think that it would have a special meaning, but it does. And one of them, one of the definitions of an item in Black's Law 8th Dictionary is a promise or order to pay money, specifically. And so a promise or order to pay is currency.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. And so anytime there's an order to pay, when you get an order to pay, you can send it to Treasury. And there's some other locations you can send to within the IRS because they're kind of an administrative arm of this process. And they'll send a wire transfer. That's another type of coin or currency that may be held. It's not coin, but it's currency. And they'll send that to the creditor.
Have you tried doing any of these tactics before?
I've done it. I haven't tried it. I've done it.
Wow.
So yes.
And yeah. It happened. It went through. It was a success.
Yep. Thank you. Yep. the fastest and best success I've had was with the IRS. Commercial creditors will, because there's a lot of, customer service people, and they just have no idea what to do when they get this. This isn't money.
Yeah, exactly.
They're going to go along with the conventional view of it, which is if it's not a you don't send us a wire transfer or a bank draft, they don't know how to recognize it. So there's ways around it. And so from there, the nuts and bolts methods get a little bit tedious and convoluted. As an example, I'll use a notary to send things because I'll want to use that notary as a return address. And that way they can sign an affidavit of silence because in commerce, silence is agreement. And it's also fraud. If you're doing business with someone and you're trying to communicate and they go silent, that's fraud. And so there are ways to paint them into the corner. And so now if someone were to just try to do or take care of a bill right now and do this process with what I've said so far, it would just be a train wreck. It would just be a big mess. There's quite a bit to being able to execute this. Because the system is so resistant to it. You know, the banks at the commercial loan level are purely parasitic.
Definitely.
They don't have any risk. They don't have any skin in the game because the Treasury makes the money that just passes through their facility and onto whoever it is that got the loan. But the bank is the one that's got their hand out for the repayment. And so if people found out about this, it would completely kill the banking industry.
Well, how is this even possible?
Well, that's where we got it. That's where we have to go all the way back to June 5th of 1933. And when gold got pulled out of circulation, there's a couple of facts that are always readily available on the surfaces. We don't use gold coins anymore. And what I've satisfied myself to after reading enough equity books is that property has to go both ways in a contract or you didn't execute it.
Mm.
So it was kind of like an algebra problem. So where's the X? Where's the missing variable? And to me, that was property. Where is it? And so, first of all, we've gone way too fast in trying to digest this, you know, in terms of and understanding this at the interview level. We probably won't understand it, and probably if this is the first that anybody's ever been exposed to it, this probably couldn't take much more away from this than there's something here to know. Because you have to study contracts, and it's not that difficult. It's just that, you know, going through any particular public school system, that's never a topic that would ever come up. You know, so when is anybody ever exposed to that sort of thing? And it'd be, you know, law or pre-law in secondary education.
So is this a matter of just kind of slipping through the loopholes?
No, it's the other way around. Okay. The loophole it has been put on us to use borrowed currency. The legitimate system is if it is the distinction between when people are saying, you know, that citizens are slaves. I don't know if you've come across a lot of that kind of.
Sure.
This is the nuts and bolts aspect of it.
Well, aren't we born a product of the corporation of the United States of America? Doesn't it say that pretty much on your birth certificate that's printed out on banknote paper?
It does for that entity. And the instant you accept joinder to it, now you're a party. But you never have to be a party to that separate entity unless you do it willingly. And sometimes willingly comes with ignorance. You just didn't know any better, and failure to object, it would appear that you agree. And so, earlier I mentioned something about there's a little bit to know here in contracts. Mm-hmm. Now there's a little bit to know in what a trust is. And there's two kinds of trust, just starting, just conversationally. There's implied and express trusts. And so within those, there are many different kinds. An implied trust can be something as simple as if you ask me to go pick something up for you and deliver it to you. A trust was there, and I would just be the trustee, and I don't have a proprietary right to that property. And so that's what's going on with that birth certificate, is there's a trust going on. And so just because they use the same name doesn't mean that it's us. And so one of the ways that they try to distinguish the system, tries to distinguish and show you in your face that it's not you, is they'll put your name either in all caps, which is traditionally representative of a dead entity, but it's still an entity, like the all capital letter name of a ship is an example. And you always see all caps on a tombstone.
I didn't think about that.
And another way to do it is to do last name first, comma, you know, the last name, comma, first. And so just to illustrate that, when any people that you know that you're talking to directly, they would just call you Lana. And I mean, I can't imagine your mother calling you by your last name. It would be completely awkward, right?
That's
not, yeah, because that isn't the name used to separate you from everybody else. That's the family name. And so I don't know what the Italians, maybe it's D-E-L, or maybe that's Spanish that means of, and Irish, you know, it'll be an O and an apostrophe and Thomas, and it means of the Thomases. And so that's, those are some indications of how the family name was used properly. And so the first name, or more properly, the given name or Christian name, is that's just you. That's that name matches up to that man or woman. But we want to talk about a person. It's both names put together, and it's called a legal name.
And there's also a difference between person and peoples.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but conversationally, if someone uses the word person, they may very well mean people. And so now it comes down to intent. What did someone intend by the use of that word? And I think that's where a lot of the argument comes in when people want to argue about what the word person means. And a word can never have a meaning. Only people do. Only people have a meaning as to what they intend by that use. And so a word can only have definitions. And so that's, I think, something else that people kind of need to be a little bit more aware of is a word doesn't have a meaning. It's only the intent of the user. And so that's something else to ask, you know, when you're getting formal letters from anybody, is, hey, what does this mean? Who are you writing to, a legal entity or a man or woman? They won't answer it, but that would be the way to go.
So what are some other tips for people if they want to navigate around IRS, driver's licenses, insurance, police, all these basically civic duties that are enforced upon us?
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that can be pretty heavy if they're just scratching the surface. You have to know how to navigate the system, and I think the better you are at and the more willing someone would be to go to court, then the less friction and conflict they'd have. But
I always wonder what the point in going to court even is. I mean, isn't the game of court rigged for them to win?
Yeah.
Isn't it better just to stay out of it and not be there at all?
Yeah, some people say that's the case. But then here's what I wonder. If they take that so far that they're scared to go to court versus they really feel that it's a strategic and tactical reason, then they'll be defeated. You can't have that deep of a weakness. You can't have that much fear in going in.
Mm-hmm.
I've had some fairly lengthy debates with some people. The problem that I had with the conversation is I just wanted to have it at a conversational level and entertain both sides. And the conversations that I've had got so confrontational that we weren't really exchanging ideas.
Yeah.
Which is all I wanted to do. And so I haven't really heard and spent that much time with that.
You told me earlier, you said, and this is a quote, in the same manner in which a thing is bound, it is loosened. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, that's a maxim of law. I would say that's something else that people need to be aware of too, is just the raw fundamental principles. And you'll see those in maxims. And so what I meant by that is whatever attachments the systems have to either people or persons or whatever, if the individual people want to extricate themselves, they have to understand what adhesion contracts they have with the system. And so you can't just go saying that they don't have, the system doesn't have control over them and they're just demanding freedom, because there may be so many adhesion contracts that they're not aware of.
What are those contracts? Can you talk about those?
Yeah, well, that is usually in licenses and wherever you submit applications and register. Anytime you register for something, you partnered up with the government.
So, yeah, you signed a piece of paper, basically.
Mm-hmm. And so you have to be able to intelligently undo those adhesion contracts in the same way that you got bound to them, rather than just going in and start saying that there's no law. Sometimes people just get the slightest taste of doing some of their own legal research, and they can jump way to way too far, way too quick. And so what I meant by that, I don't remember exactly what the phrase was that I gave you, but in my mind it's always, as a thing is bound, so it is unbound.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to go and untie whatever those adhesion contracts are. You just go undo them. Because all contract is consent on both sides. And so you just one of the elements then would be to undo the consent.
So if I have a driver's license and I don't want that anymore, I want to undo it, how would I go about doing that?
Hypothetically, well, you'd rescind the contract. And so you would rescind the contract for whatever is true for you. Because maybe you do drive. I think it's 18 U.S.C. 31 that says a motor vehicle is something used in commerce. And so you can't have a taxi driver or a limo driver saying, hey, you guys can't have your thumb on me. I don't want a driver's license anymore, because the guy's out conducting commerce and that is regulated. But a driver's license is something specifically for conducting commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And then the scam is that's generally and socially known that that's not the case, that it's everybody's got to have one. You know, everybody knows it. Kind of like everybody knows Easter eggs come from the Easter bunny. It's the same logic. But so if you wanted to undo that, you would have to go rescind the signature, and now you're undoing a contract, and so now you'd have to undo a contract for reasons that are voidable. And so you just have to void it for whatever was true for you. You know, for some people, there wasn't full disclosure. For others, it was a unilateral contract. You know, just whatever makes sense.
Well, let's say I want to drive, but I don't acknowledge their laws, and a cop pulls me over, and I say, well, I don't have any contract with you, so you don't have anything on me. What happens then? I still get arrested, right?
Yeah, probably. But there's also ways to then... I know of people that have rescinded their contract and then held, whether it's the Secretary of State or the Department of Licensing, held their feet to the fire in terms of the conversation, and to say, hey, look, this is what I believe. Is am I wrong? And they get information and data put into the system so that when you're pulled over and the police look into your driver's license or whatever private ID that you've created and have established and recorded with the system, or your license plate, and they'll just see, you don't have to say anything to them. And that's what I meant by if you can't just do it too much too soon, because that cop won't know. He won't know a thing about it. He's just trained to herd sheep. That's all his job is to get as many sheep into the pen as possible. And so to do it the way you suggested might be, well, you might have to get arrested and spend a night in jail and then find out and have an intelligent conversation with the judge, who is also intent on defeating you too, though.
Of course.
Yeah. So now you have to know the rules of the game and not law to have that conversation work out to your satisfaction.
Now, do you have a background in contracts or law?
No, formally, not at all.
Yeah.
No, I just kind of studied this stuff on my own. The money thing interested me so much that I thought, well, that's great if this is the system in theory, but if all the creditors reject it, what good does it do? I mean, if I can't actually see this through, it doesn't. The theory's only mildly interesting at best, and it might just frustrate me to know it and not be able to implement it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I then went and looked into how to enforce it and all those nuts and bolts things.
I also heard you say, when talking about the IRS, which is registered in Puerto Rico, as we know, but the Revenue Service, you were talking about revenuing currency. Can you explain that?
The Internal Revenue Service, Trust Number 62, Puerto Rico. Yeah, that's the revenue service, that is taking the private property and converting it into the public. That's the revenue aspect of the revenue service. If you take a bill, sometimes you can send it directly, any commercial bill, let's say a mortgage, you send it to the IRS very conversationally. This isn't, you don't just send it to any location, but if you send it to the right one with the right information, they will send that into Treasury and be the middleman. They'll be the revenue service that will then wire transfer to the creditor. So the two venues are the public and the private. Your private labor gets converted into electronic digits. The how-to on that would probably be a completely separate conversation. And there's lots of folks out there that do that. It's called set-off. And a lot of people refer to it as A for V, accepted for value, which is kind of, that's some of the language that's used in the paperwork. I don't know why it's referred to.
Can you simplify it a little bit for us?
So as much as there's a guy that talks about, I think his name is True Ott or something like that. He's kind of a unique name. And he was talking about Federal Reserve notes that they have no intrinsic value. And so neither did the bank notes back when we deposited gold and we'd get bank notes back as a receipt. That's what a bill is like, is it just functions as the administrative paperwork. It's not the value in and of itself.
Sure, and I remember he even said that the U.S. dollar is basically backed by the faith of the American people. That's it.
Yeah, and I don't think he's digging deep enough there. But anyway, that's and what I'm trying to say here is not incompatible with what he's saying either. I'm just saying that there's some deeper levels to this. So just a real quick nuts and bolts on how you would set off a bill. If you got, let's say you got a mortgage, at the bottom of there's always a coupon. And a coupon is a specie of money. And so you can just return the coupon either directly to the creditor or send it to the IRS. I send it to everybody that'll listen. I send it out three or four times to various locations. And to keep it from being forgeries, I also let them know that, hey, look, I've sent this same set off to three other locations, and then I also numbered the instruments so that they're uniquely identified so that it doesn't cause any confusion. And I send it back to the IRS, and I say, hey, set it off. Here's the private exemption number, and I'll use the Social Security number without any dashes, and I refer to it as the private exemption number. And then they can just take that to Treasury and liquidate it, and then wire back over to the creditor's account. And I'll just put all that in a notice and say, and I just write on the face of the bill, I accept, and I finish filling out the coupon at the bottom, and I'll endorse the back of it like a check. and just send it out. And I don't actually send it. I use a notary to do it so that if they go silent, it's as agreement. And so I'll get the notary to sign an affidavit saying that he never, not only didn't hear anything for and on behalf of me, but he didn't hear anything from the creditor either.
Wow.
And so ultimately now, what if they sue you or they make claims against your credit report? Now you have documentation to say, hey, wait a minute, that's kind of interesting topic, but this is the information that I have. Now, it's standing on that claim and not having an attorney push you off of it is completely different too. This, lots of people ask me, you know, they want to know the right way to do this so that it doesn't get messed up. And so I always ask them, you know, do you believe that if you do everything perfectly that the system won't push back on you? And if they do believe that, then I know that there's too much naivety to move forward with this. It's like, I don't think I can help you, because just giving someone the actual process, there's no the actual process.
Mm-hmm.
It's like pushing them out into deep water, and they won't know how to handle it if when they encounter an adversary.
Is there some interesting observer effect that's happening here? Consciousness that is affecting paper somehow?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And also I found that the better job you do up front, the less likely pushback is from the other side. But banks are notorious for causing all kinds of problems, at least with some of the people that have done this. And in my experience, they'll really push back and call it fraud, and they'll tell you that you're being investigated, and they really make a stink over it.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
But that hasn't happened to you.
Yeah.
It has.
Yeah. Yeah, not directly. Well, one time it has gone directly to court.
And what happened?
And what happened was they held a hearing before I had time to get in there, and they just steamrolled it and defaulted me. But that's okay. Now we just keep going again. And so now, you know, what other recourse do I have is to turn in a report to Treasury for money laundering. And one of the definitions of money laundering is hiding the source of it. And so there's all kinds of recourse now that I have. I mean, it's not, these processes are never over until you're satisfied.
Mm.
So you just have to have the confidence that this is right. And just stay on it.
So do bankers know about this?
I don't know.
Do the Rockefellers know about this?
They have to. Yeah. At some level, there's a guy named Winston Shrout that does seminars on various aspects of law and commerce and that kind of thing. And he said one time that he was talking to someone who was a real high up banking insider. And Winston asked the guy, how high up do I got to go to talk to someone who understands private exemption? And the guy's reply was executive vice president on a need to know basis.
Wow.
See, most people just perceive money as once currency is out in circulation, that's all there is to it. And there's never a question as to how did they get there? How did it get there? And who's ultimately got the right to it? And how do we make more? And what do we attribute it to? And so that was, you know, if I were to really take my time and go over this in several sections, we'd start with we'd do an entire amount of time on contracts and trusts, and this now it gets tedious and it's kind of boring unless we really have an eye towards, you know, there's some useful information there. But one of the chapters that needs to be learned is what corporations and fictions are. And once you understand that fictions can't create anything because they don't actually exist, and then we can see that it can't create money. The United States is a corporation, and they even call themselves that. So it's not like it's a controversy. In United States Code 28.3002, it says the United States means a federal corporation. It's just clean and simple. So a fiction can't create anything, and so, you know, it can't create property. And I think that's all the systems are so compartmentalized that to see money from the highest level like a board game is very difficult, especially when some of those guys at the, you know, the banking, the bureaucrats inside of it are so weighed down with just individual bureaucratic regulations that they have to know. You know, their mind just isn't free to take in and see the big picture.
Can you talk a little more about credit score as a unit of measure for labor?
Yeah, that is what measures our labor productivity. And so when the credit score first got when it was first developed, it kind of reminds me of like the automobile industry. It wasn't very sophisticated, and there wasn't all that much to it. And its core essence then, when it was first created, is to measure how much property you're producing by labor. And that's where it started. And then after that, there's a lot of ratios, debt to income, and I'm actually not very familiar with how sophisticated it is now with all its separate elements, because all I wanted to know was that core element of where it's measuring property. But when people first get engaged in commerce when they're fairly young, 18, 19, 20, they haven't put out that much property into the system. And so regardless of what their credit score is, that's some of the toughest times for people across the board to get a loan. And that's why, is because they're not getting a loan that's tapping into their productivity that they've already produced.
Yeah, I see.
So, yeah, so if you're 17, 18, 19, you haven't put anything out yet. And once someone, the other end of the spectrum would be an established professional that has a very high income, let's say doctor, lawyer, dentist, that kind of thing, where they're making fairly well into six figures. Those guys are putting out lots of property into the system, and their credit score is so high that they probably get more credit offers than they want to utilize. You know, stuff in the mail all the time, and offers from their lines of credit and current credit cards and that kind of thing. And that's why, see, corporations, if they get a hold of your social security number and all your personal data, they can go with power of attorney and go tap into your credit score and liquidate for themselves. Just if you go and get that's why when people get their credit score run, or if they fill out an application, the second time or more that they fill out an application for credit, that's why it's a derogatory mark on your credit score, is to have someone check it, is because they actually liquidated some of your assets. They turned it into currency. In other words, they literally turned it into money, and now you can't tap in as much to it, and that's why.
So where were those assets?
It didn't physically exist.
Exactly.
It didn't physically exist. But because you labored, you are now prevented from liquidating your labor. That's why the second time you go and apply for a loan and they say no, one of the problems is you just applied. It's not that you applied for your credit score. It's that some of your labor was liquidated and now someone else is using it. You can't. That's the real issue. Money was actually created at that point in time.
Mm.
Yeah. And so the system can't create money in an unlimited fashion. And so therein lies the limitations. You know, you can only tap into it so frequently and for so much value. And that's why.
So have you looked into the masterminds behind this system?
No, you know, very little. And some of the questions that I've had, I actually got to spend an afternoon with Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
And pick his brain a little bit, but I had some very specific questions that didn't go that deep, and I would like to. I'm kind of curious to know at what point in time was it schemed that labor could get swapped out for gold? Clearly, some guys were really engineering that concept years in advance before it happened.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So how do you see currency changing form in the future then?
Well, the more people that know about this, the more the dollar is stabilized. I don't know if you've heard various experts that are absolutely convinced that the dollar was going to just crash.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think they were right in that there was an intent to crash the dollar. But I think so many people have found out about their own private exemption that when they do that, they release money into the economy that's not borrowed into existence. And every time someone does that, it takes a little bit of control away from the system itself, the bankers. Because if they're always in charge of how much money is owed and to who it's owed to, they can steer it in any direction. So the more people that find out about their private exemption and take control of their own property, the more it stabilizes that particular currency. You know, and here's just another way to triangulate this. Is a dollar is merely a unit of measure. And I think you can even find that on Wikipedia. You don't have to go too far from a couple of links to see that a dollar is a unit of measure. And so I think money takes you to medium of exchange, and medium of exchange takes you to unit of account. And that unit of account is unit of measure. And so the question should be, what are we measuring? If that's the unit, what are we measuring?
Exactly.
and Wikipedia doesn't get anywhere near it. But that's another way to triangulate it. And what we're measuring is, and this gets really abstract, but it's property.
Mm-hmm.
A dollar used to be specifically a certain amount of silver. And so it couldn't be just the weight, because we also had to know its fineness. How pure is it? Is it 90% or 99% or 80%? Because that's secondary consideration. But it was, and I think it was a troy ounce, and I think it was 90%, not 99%. But the bottom line is that's what a dollar was, that unit of measure. And then there's just other little clues in the system. One of them is, you've seen a double strike dollar sign.
Yeah.
And there's also a single strike. In other words, a single line through it.
That's right.
A double strike dollar sign was always used exclusively for commodity money. That is gold or silver. And so if we wanted to use a bill of exchange or representative money, that's the only other kind, the symbol was a single strike, a single line through the X. And so there's another little way that the truth is always right in our face. So anytime that a debt collector is asking for a debt paid with a single strike dollar sign, they're not asking for property. They're asking for representative money. Wow. In other words, they're just asking for the claim ticket. They don't actually need the property.
And what about store of value? Can you talk more about that?
Well, that we've kind of outpaced the language a little bit. So store of value is that would be commodity money like gold or silver. And we don't use that anymore. And so once we abandoned gold in 33, June 5th, we're not storing value in Federal Reserve notes or digital representation. It's the value is not stored there anymore. And so that store of value is more along the lines of, well, we got a birth certificate over in Treasury. And so we know somebody's putting out some property to some degree somewhere. We don't know the details of it, but that's probably the store of value. And it's not stored directly. It's just sort of representative. It's real. It's abstract. There's not an account there with a specific amount of money already in it. That's not what's going on. It's just that when we have achieved a certain credit score, Treasury is allowed to actually make that amount of money on the spot. And that just makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on buying gold, and where's all the gold gone?
I think a lot of the gold, I'm not too interested in it. Now that I know that property never left the system. And I'm a little concerned that the big boys at the top would reintroduce gold and put too much emphasis on having gold-backed currency again. Because it's a limited commodity, and our labor is unlimited. I only have speculation as to where most of the gold has gone, and I think it's gone to private central banks that's used between countries. When gold got pulled out, it got concentrated at, I think, the Federal Reserve banks, and then from there, a lot of it ended up in New York. I have no idea what's in Fort Knox. My guess is there's a lot of gold there at Fort Knox, and I think some people speculate that it's all been taken out of there.
Yeah.
And my guess is that there's plenty of gold there. The question with auditing is that it's going to raise too many eyebrows when people that aren't insiders see whose name is on it. I think that's what they're really hiding. Not that there's none there, but that who actually owns it. And here's also another way to look at what happened when gold got pulled out in 1933, is that was the United States with HJR 192, they declared bankruptcy. And that's a prerequisite for a country to be a member of the United Nations, is they have to be bankrupt.
That's crazy, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, they can't use gold. And so I think it's fairly well known, at least at the attorney level, that a bankrupt entity is not allowed to handle its own assets. When a company goes bankrupt, there's a trustee that's at arm's length, that's not affiliated with the company, that handles its assets. And so that's what happened at June 5th, 1933, is that the United States was no longer competent to handle its own assets. And in that 31 USC 5118, where it says other than gold and silver, that's also known as the gold clause, and it says the United States may not pay out any gold coin. Well, that's why they're a bankrupt entity, and the bank and the Federal Reserve and the banking cartels is actually the trustee over the top of it. And so a bankrupt entity doesn't have the authority to regulate its regulator. And that's one of the reasons why the banking industry has fooled so far out of control. Is I think a lot of people wonder why the United States doesn't have more authority over the banks, and it's because they can't. They're the bankrupt. They're the ward in a guardian ward relationship.
Mm.
You know, the kid doesn't call the shots over the babysitter. It's just a rot principle. And so there is no regulation over the top of the banks. It's just public perception, and as much as they can get away with, it is all that actually regulates them.
Yeah. How does inflation fit into the picture? Because I thought the 1792 Coinage Act basically made that treasonous.
I think that act speaks to debasing the currency. Is that right?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I actually have that too. The penalty for fraud or embezzlement by officers or employees of the mint of debasing or making the currency to be of less weight or value was death. That was the penalty.
Yeah. So inflation now is just the volume of currency in circulation. And so if it's based on labor, I don't know how they could debase labor. Since we're not talking about tangible property in gold and silver. In other words, they don't keep watering it down. It used to be fairly common for people to shave a little bit of material off of gold coins or silver coins. And so that was the introduction of having a grooved edge or a ridged along the edges, and so mm-hmm. that people could tell if they shaved that material off. And so that's the debasing. And here's something else too, is that some of those acts only apply to the republic and not the democracy. See, the democracy is the United States as a corporation. It didn't start out as a corporation. It started out as a trust. And they exist simultaneously. And so that's some of the people that are upset over whether Obama had a birth certificate or not.
Mm-hmm.
That only matters if he's in the office of the republic, and I think it's fairly common knowledge that the United States is a democracy, at least as far as what he's in charge of.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're two different things, and that should go back to that Coinage Act of 1796. Is that right?
Yep, that's right. Or 1792. Sorry.
92. Yeah, that probably applies to the republic.
Well, I thought it was unconstitutional, basically, for the government to even be involved with money and inflation.
Mm-hmm. The republic it is. The corporation can do whatever it wants. Two different entities.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And so there's another knot to untie right there. And when I said that, you know, one of the things we have to get through is our fictions and corporations, that would be part of it. Is it'd probably take a few hours just to lay out some of the differences there.
I want to give you a comment here that I heard in a video. Let's see, Paul Volcker, you know, chairman of Federal Reserve, at a training seminar, he said, paper money for consumption of the goy, non-Jewish human cattle. And he burnt some money. This was at a seminar, like, paper money, it's worthless. It's for consumption of the goy. What do you think about that?
Yeah, yep. Yeah, it's definitely small change. You know, when I heard that guy say that, what I was wondering is, okay, so what's the alternative? Even the biggest players in the game still use something for exchange, and they probably use electronic digits or gold.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that they've painted themselves into a corner. I mean, in other words, if you have a board game with money like Monopoly, and if only one player has gold, it then becomes something that, since no one else can get their hands on it, they'll just use something else for exchange, and you can make gold obsolete. And I hope that's what's happened, actually. Because if gold just becomes obsolete and we can just use treasury for set off, it really takes a big weight off of individual shoulders and not just the economy in general. You know, instead of waiting for the president to do things or the government to fix jobs and the economy, man, talk about waiting forever. Just, you know, go set your house off or go set off your IRS bills.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I talk to a lot of people that do that.
So what kind of bills would this system apply to?
Well, that commercial debt. So I'll make a distinction between that and private. Let's say you owed a friend or you owed your mom some money or someone that you knew. It's a lot more difficult to get that set off. But commercial bills already come with the coupon at the bottom of the statement, which is intended to be sent back and to be monetized. And so those bills, they send you the kit that's already ready to do it, and it has the routing number and account number down at the bottom of them, just ready to go. So most people wouldn't know how to create that bill that would be smoothly processed if you owed someone that you knew. In other words, the bills that you might get from the utility company or the car loan or vouchers from the IRS, mortgages, credit cards, that kind of thing, they all have a coupon at the bottom ready to go. And sometimes it says coupon, sometimes it doesn't, but there'll be a little dotted line and there's a picture of a scissor and it says, detach this and send it back with your payment. Well, that actually is the payment. You're double paying them. And so there's another aspect maybe to the occult knowledge of
definitely,
this.
Definitely, yeah.
Well, do you remember back around the end of 08 and the first part of 09 when the mainstream media was putting a lot of time and energy into this dilemma of how is it possible that banks are failing and they're too big to fail, and yet the bankers are, there's billions of dollars available for their bonuses?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's two streams of income for that bank. One is those coupons at the bottom. They would send those to Treasury, and I've done some research on routing numbers. And so there's some very hidden routing numbers that are completely unknown to the system. And so that currency would get liquidated. Those coupons would get liquidated, and that was the money available for the bankers and their bonuses. But for the money that already existed, where folks didn't have enough money to pay their conventional mortgages with bank drafts, with checks, that there wasn't enough currency in circulation to be able to handle all those mortgages. And so that's why the banks weren't getting paid. And that's the money that goes to the infrastructure, and that's more of the publicly seen money. And that's why the banks were failing in that aspect. And there was plenty of currency available for the bankers. And that's something else too, is they needed some hush money, and they needed to be able, how does the system crash and how do we keep those guys quiet? And that was how they did it, is they liquidated those coupons. I did a set off for a guy with his mortgage, and the bank got back to him three times, hey, you still haven't paid this. And I did it myself, and I thought, I know I did this right. And then I thought, wait a minute, no, I only think I did. Just this, maybe don't get, you know, too sure here. Let's go back through it. And I went back through his process with a fine tooth comb. And I just eliminated one variable after the other. And then I got to the point where I was looking at the routing numbers on the coupons, and I thought, wait a minute, I'm taking that for granted. I don't know that that's a good routing number. And so I went and did some research where you can look up a bank and find its routing number,
mm-hmm.
or you can look up a routing number and find what bank it's attributed to.
Mm.
And so when I looked at this guy's bank, I looked up to see, okay, what routing number should he be using for a wire transfer? Okay, there it is. That makes sense. There's only one of them. There should be several routing numbers for checks because we want those going to various places across the country. But electronically, we only need one for wire transfer. And then when I typed in the routing number that was on the coupon at the bottom, I couldn't find it anywhere. I couldn't find it, you know, on the bank's website. I couldn't find it where websites are out there to reverse engineer routing numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And then Google couldn't find it. I just put it in quotation marks and asked Google to tell me what this number is. And it said zero results. And that's pretty unusual.
Yeah.
So I thought, that's what's going on. That's what these guys are doing with these things.
Wow.
And that's where that currency came from. And that's why there's plenty of money on one side of the fence and not and it's deficient on the other.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a world we live in. How did you stumble across this again?
You know, I used to study common law, you know, the English law, and I didn't really have much of a handle on admiralty. And one of the things that first piqued my interest was Jordan Maxwell talking about birth certificates being a bond. And then I thought, well, I don't know what a bond is. And so I thought, man, that's some pretty heavy stuff. And I didn't believe it, and I didn't not believe it. I just thought, well, let me see if I can come to the same conclusion here with some of what he's saying. And then I went and just got books on bonds and bills of exchange and negotiable instruments because I didn't know what they were. And I always thought, well, why do we need those if we have cash? Well, what's going on here? And I just slowly started peeling out back the layers you know, of the onion. And I got to a few places where I got stuck. And one of them was property. If property has to go both directions, and I knew for sure from listening to somebody else that when we use Federal Reserve notes, it's called the novation. It's not property going both directions. And I thought, there's got to be something in between there.
Yeah.
There's got to be. And just the timing of things happening right around 1933 to 38 was beyond coincidence, too. You know, the IRS getting set up. And
that's right.
And birth certificates right in there was really got put into high gear.
Mm.
And the credit score. And so I thought, well, if it all got created that quickly, they got to be related somehow. So I just started looking in and seeing closer and closer connections.
So do you lay any of this out in video by any chance?
Well, I haven't gone out of my way to do it. And so I've explained this a few times. And
because visuals definitely help, kind of a step-by-step thing.
It does. And you know what? My buddy Nate just said he's going to set up a WordPress website for me so I can put some of this stuff out there. Anytime I've ever done this, it's always been someone has just asked to record me. I've never really gone out of my way to get the info out. I've just kind of helped people with and especially recently with mortgages and foreclosures, just helping people that are in that situation. And usually I only get to help people that are in dire straits already because...
Yeah, they have nothing left to lose. Why not, right?
Got it. Yeah, I helped one guy that was, after he was foreclosed on, he was served with paperwork that he had 14 days to reply. And then he let 10 days go by before he got a hold of me.
Oh, no.
After foreclosure. So, and I think I got that one saved. The attorneys have put him off 30 days three times. And they haven't known how to deal with his paperwork. And it might be a little too soon. January 22nd, I'll know for sure.
I just wonder when they receive it. And some, you know, a clerk gets it or something. And then what do they do? Like, what do I do with this paperwork?
Yeah,
they pass
yeah.
it along to their manager. And does their manager understand these concepts?
I think so. Are you asking specifically with the payment then, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, and that's why, so if I send this to the creditor directly, I don't send it to customer service. I send it to the CFO.
Okay.
And so now we're not going through those various steps. You got to go to the top. And because you also have to be able to, how do you hold someone accountable if you only send something to a corporation like Bank of America or Citibank? It doesn't exist. You know, only the the trustees there do, the people that are in charge. So that's why I send stuff to the CFO. Is that way, if there's any sort of negligence in handling the paperwork, I know whose name to put on it on that complaint in the future.
Well, Spencer, thanks again for your time today. We do appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Tell everyone how they can reach you and listen to more of your ideas on the nature of currency.
Well, I only have saltydriftwood@gmail.com. And it might be a couple of days early before I get a website. I might have to get back to you on that.
No worries. And since Spencer's in Seattle, I'm going to leave everyone with an oldie by Alice in Chains. The song is called Wood. We'll talk again soon.